Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 17th. I'm Grace Dorfler filling in for Leslie Thatcher on KPCW's Local News Hour this morning. Currently, it is 50 degrees in Park City. It's a little cooler in the Heber Valley right now at 32 degrees. With details about the weather forecast, we have ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. Watch out for those high winds that are going to be picking up as we go throughout the morning into the afternoon hours. Keeping two hands on the steering wheel if you're in those high-profile vehicles, as those winds could gust 40 to 60 miles per hour at times this afternoon. We'll also see increasing chances for valley rain and mountain snow showers building in as we get into the daytime hours today. Not looking at anything too heavy, but at times we could see a period of heavy rain or mountain snow as we get towards the midday time frame. Temperatures for highs will be in the mid-40s for us in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing to near 50 in the Heber Valley. Tonight, we'll see any lingering showers turn over to snow showers as temperatures drop down into the low 20s for us by early Thursday morning in the Heber Valley. We'll drop down into the low to mid-20s for us early Thursday morning as you get towards the Park City area. Again, we'll see off and on chances of some scattered snow showers in the mountains as we go throughout your Thursday afternoon. So Park City, you could have a couple of flakes flying around with some very light accumulations out there. Temperatures climbing into the low 40s. We'll be in the mid-40s for highs in the Heber Valley. As we get into your Friday, we're going to see increasing clouds once again. That atmospheric river will begin to turn by Friday evening into Friday night. That'll bring increasing chances of valley rain and mountain snow showers. And we'll see off and on rain continuing into your Saturday for the Heber Valley with highs in the 40s. And in Park City, we could have a little bit of a rain-snow mix at times. Probably more rain than snow, but a rain-snow mix nonetheless as we go throughout your Saturday. We'll keep that unsettled weather into at least Sunday morning before we start to dry things out by Sunday afternoon. Temperatures for highs in the mid-40s in Park City. Highs near 50 for the Heber Valley. As we head into your Christmas week, yeah, we start off on a quiet note with a mixture of clouds and sunshine and a warm note. Temperatures nearing 50 in Park City. Temperatures into the low to mid-50s into the Heber Valley. As we look at your latest forecast with the Wasatch Back, I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And on the phone with an update is the Utah Avalanche Center from the backcountry. How's it looking out there this morning?
Hey, yeah, it's Brooke Mauschen with the Utah Avalanche Center. You know, right now we still have this poor structure in the backcountry. It's mostly weak snow that we have out there. We have our persistent weak layer made out of old faceted snow. It's been sitting out with this period of high pressure that we've had. In places that will be loading that snowpack today, we could see a bump in danger, but closer to Park City, it looks like there's some more modest snow totals like folks were discussing earlier. So, you know, generally like today, we just want to keep an eye on those more like northerly facing slopes at mid and upper elevations, because that's where that persistent weak layer is currently hanging out.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Brooke.
Mm-hmm.
Have a good day.
You too.
That was Brooke from the Utah Avalanche Center with today's avalanche forecast. I'm KPCW's Grace Dorfler filling in for Leslie Thatcher this morning on Local News Hour. Up next in the show, we have some updates from across the Wasatch Back. First, we'll start out with an update from Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation Executive Director Mike Lors. He has some updates to share about everything from PFAS to the latest flush index. After that, we'll hear from Park City leaders. Acting City Manager Jody Emery and Deputy City Manager Heather Sneddon are sharing previews about this week's City Council meeting, including the Clark Ranch conservation easement. And then to close out the hour, we'll hear from Heber City Council Member Yvonne Barney. She shares a recap of last night's council meeting and the year in the review for Heber City. International Migrants Day is tomorrow, December 18th, and Holy Cross Ministries is encouraging locals to tell their neighbors and friends from around the world that they are welcome. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
International Migrants Day was established by the United Nations in 2000. The day of recognition highlights the complexity of migration and the ways in which conflicts, climate-related disasters, and economic pressures drive people to seek safety. This year's theme is Migrate Story, Cultures and Development. It's meant to illustrate how migration drives growth, enriches societies, and helps communities connect, adapt, and support one another. In light of International Migrants Day, Holy Cross Ministries is emphasizing that it stands in solidarity with the immigrant community it serves in Utah. Executive Director Emmy Gardner said the Sisters of the Holy Cross, which sponsors Holy Cross Ministries, has a similar stance on migration as this year's theme.
We come from a place of assuming good intent that most people want to stay where they are, right? They want to be in their culture and their language and their foods and all of that, but that for whatever reason, they need to leave.
Gardner said there have been many changes in the immigration process since President Donald Trump took office. According to the Migration Policy Institute, there has been a sharp drop in unauthorized migration at the U.S.-Mexico border due to new border controls and asylum restrictions, as well as promised mass deportations. There were 444,000 migrant encounters at the border in fiscal year 2025, compared to 2.1 million the year prior. Gardner said funding for organizations that support immigrant families, such as the International Rescue Committee and Catholic Community Services, has also been cut by the administration.
While there's no more refugees coming in, the folks that they have here that were being resettled, they lost the funding to continue to support those folks. It's just a hot mess.
Holy Cross Ministries focuses on health, education, and justice when supporting immigrant families. It has also traditionally helped immigrants who are victims of domestic violence. Now, Gardner said the nonprofit is focusing on supporting kids with mixed status.
Kids that are in mixed status families that are feeling the stress of what if I come home and my parents aren't there? What do I do? And then what if I've got to be responsible for my younger siblings and all of that kind of, I mean, issues kids should not have to be dealing with at this point in their lives.
To provide enough support, Holy Cross Ministries is working on increasing its mental health space. The nonprofit has 8 therapists and the Wasatch Back waitlist is full. There's about an 8-week waiting period. To aid in that support, Holy Cross Ministries encourages locals to reach out to migrants. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And the Sundance Institute has selected 54 short films to screen during its last festival in Utah this January. The Sundance Film Festival will include a host of documentary, live-action, and animated short films from the United States and around the world. A special Park City Legacy short film collection will also be shown as a tribute to Sundance's Utah roots ahead of its 2027 move to Boulder, Colorado. The Nonprofit Film Institute has not released the titles of shorts from past festivals. It calls the program a surprise screening. The Park City Legacy program also includes full-length features and a potential panel discussion at the Egyptian Theater, which will not screen films in its final year. The 2026 Sundance Film Festival runs January 22nd to February 1st. For a list of the 54 shorts included in Utah's last Sundance, visit kpcw.org. And in the studio with me this morning is Centerville Basin Water Reclamation District Executive Director Mike Lors. Mike, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Grace.
So I understand we have the latest flush index to share.
We do. So we estimated that there were 121,970 visitor nights for the month of November. Now, that's a fairly significant increase from the previous year of about 15%. So we're happy to see that. And year to date, we're showing based on wastewater flows that the overall visitor nights is up about 2%.
Okay. And does that flush index help you keep an eye on, like, if the tourism season is tracking with previous years?
Right. And we work with the chamber on this. We happen to be able to get an idea of the visitor nights because it's kind of an instantaneous thing. People flush and we see the wastewater coming down the pipe. And we provide this information to the chamber and then they compare it to their hotel reservation numbers. So, yeah, it's kind of a fun thing that we've started about 20 years ago, and just kind of helps us get an idea of how many people are in town.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. How do you measure a flush index?
Well, it's measured from the quantity of the wastewater, and believe it or not, the strength of the wastewater, because if a lot of people are in town and they're going to local restaurants, you will see that the wastewater strength will be higher because it has restaurant, you know, kitchen waste in the wastewater. And that's all built into a mathematical model that we use to generate the numbers.
Okay, so you do math all day. That's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's a pretty actually pretty sophisticated calculation.
No, that's really interesting. And the wastewater then, of course, is also used to keep an eye on levels of some diseases in the community, COVID and measles.
Right. So every week we monitor the wastewater for the COVID and now measles. And the two treatment plants that we operate here locally were showing that the COVID material, we look for the genetic material, is very, very low, which is good news. It is much lower than it has been in the last couple months. And so far, we haven't picked up any measles here in our local area.
Okay, that's good to hear. As far as the COVID goes, do you expect that that number will start to go up as more tourists come to town?
You know, it generally will go up a little bit when people come to town, so we'll just have to see. But yes, generally, it does go up a little bit when we have these, you know, major influxes of people. But overall, it's been going down, which is a good thing.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Glad we're not seeing any measles at the moment either. How much of a concern is it to, I saw that neighboring Wasatch County is still detecting measles in its wastewater.
Well, you know, we're just kind of the entity that monitors for the measles. Of course, the health department will give you the health part of this, but it would not be a surprise if we were to pick up measles just because we have a number of cases in Wasatch County, Utah County, and kind of surrounding us. And with the influx of people, this probably won't be a big surprise when we see it.
Yeah, understood. Yeah. And how often do you measure?
We measure at each treatment plant twice a week.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Moving on, I understand that you dealt with a cyber attack recently. Could you share a little bit about when this happened and what exactly transpired?
Sure. So recently, the Water Reclamation District was a target of an international cyber attack. And the way this took place is that our cybersecurity monitoring system notified us that we had what's called a high severity alert. Now, a high severity alert means that there's an imminent and critical threat immediately taking place. Fortunately, our system was able to stop the attack, and we were able to recover all encrypted data. But this is something that we have not seen before at this level. So we reported it to the FBI and the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Agency. And most people probably haven't heard of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, but it's part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And they are the National Coordinator for Critical Infrastructure Security. And we worked with them and come to find out that this attack was indeed very serious. It was sponsored by a Chinese state-sponsored advanced threat group. The group was most likely the Flax Typhoon Group, and they are engaged in long-term cyber espionage campaigns, primarily targeting critical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Now, you kind of look at us, we're kind of a small wastewater utility here in Park City, and you wouldn't think that they would attack an agency like us, but they are apparently attacking a large number of critical infrastructure agencies across the U.S. and across other parts of the world. And the good news is we were able to stop it. You know, kind of an analogy we have is that, you know, we had these bank robbers come into a bank and they were able to crack the door of the safe. They reached in to get the money, and an alarm went off, a secondary alarm went off, and we were able to shut the door on them, and they were not able to kind of walk off with the money, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But we have been working with the FBI, EPA Cyber Resources Group, and a number of other law enforcement agencies, and the holes in the software have been patched, and we're continuing to work with authorities, including what we call a penetration test. While we've done penetration tests in the past, this one's a little bit more involved. And typically, a penetration test is just a proactive simulated cyber attack where authorities try to breach into our system and use every tool they have to see if they can get in. And this helps us identify weaknesses and vulnerabilities that we then we work to improve. But this is being done at the national level through the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency. And, you know, I kind of put a warning out to others who deal with critical infrastructure, you know, really be careful. And this can be very serious because in this case, they could have encrypted our data, shut us down, and demanded a ransom. Or they could have just become a sleeper, as we call a sleeper in our system, we might not have known they were there. And, you know, someday the Chinese state-sponsored espionage group would then activate something to cause us havoc. So, yeah, it's pretty serious. And if anyone would like to have additional information, you know, please reach out to us and we'll be able to share additional details about this and the vulnerabilities and the specifically the server that they were able to get in on. It happens to be a GIS server, and many local governments use GIS software.
Yeah, sounds like you guys have acted pretty aggressively to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Well, we do the best we can. There's never a guarantee that that won't happen. Certainly, when you have a sophisticated group that is, you know, the Chinese sponsored group, they know what they're doing. And across the U.S., they've been able to access a fair number of GIS servers. And so it's a constant battle, and we do the best we can.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the information.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you as well about skiing this season. It sounds like the Centerville Basin Water District would like to keep PFAS out of the water supply. What steps can people take to do that?
Yeah, we've partnered with Park City Water Department and Recycled Utah on this. And the key here is we'd like to remind folks that fluoro waxes that are used for skiing are no longer approved for the Park City area. And the truth of the matter is they contain PFAS compounds. These PFAS compounds get into the snow, then they seep down into our drinking water system. And Park City has identified PFAS in some of their wells. That gets into the drinking water. We consume it. It ends up in the wastewater. And our treatment plants are not designed to remove PFAS compounds. So it ends up into our local streams. So, you know, we like to say ski fluoro free this season. So if you have ski wax that has the word fluoro or something like that on there, hey, take it down to Recycle Utah and turn it in. And use free non-fluoro waxes to help protect our local drinking water and our local environment.
Gotcha. Once PFAS is in the water, is it possible to take it out again?
You can take it out, but it's very difficult and takes pretty advanced technologies to do that, which are extremely expensive. So far, wastewater treatment plants are not required to do that, but it's something that we're looking at and we sample for.
Sounds good.
And PFAS, I might add, PFAS compounds obviously can come from these fluoro ski waxes, but PFAS compounds also come from many, many other consumer products, including nonstick cooking pans, at least some of them. And so we see kind of a wide variety of PFAS compounds in the wastewater, and we continue to monitor for those compounds, and we're looking into how we need to handle it in the future.
Yeah, and for listeners who might not be aware, PFAS, it's essentially a type of microplastic, right?
Actually, PFAS is a giant organic molecule that has a fluoride atom in it, and it's really hard to break down. That's the kind of the issue with the PFAS compounds. It's not biodegradable at all, and some people will call them kind of forever chemicals because they do hang around for a very long time. So that if you ski with fluoro waxes and it gets on the snow, it does in fact seep down into the aquifers and just simply does not break down. So that's the real problem behind this. Now, some microplastics do contain PFAS compounds as well. So in that case, it's kind of a double whammy.
Okay. Well, thank you for explaining.
Yeah.
Mike, anything else you want to add as we're heading into the holiday season?
Well, we'd just like to remind your listeners that if they have sewer odors in their homes, that is probably caused because you have an unused drain in the house someplace. And I've mentioned this before, but we continue to get calls on this. So if you have a bathroom that has a floor drain or a shower or a tub, or you have a utility room where you have a drain that is not used, every 6 months, pour a quart of water down those drains, because it keeps that little, what we call the P-trap, that little bent piece of pipe in the drain filled with water, and it keeps sewer gases from entering your home. And these sewer gases can be quite awful at times. And it's a very simple problem to solve by simply keeping a little bit of water in your drains every, say, you know, 6 months or so.
Sounds good. Yeah. Appreciate the tip.
Sure.
And thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, thank you for having me, Grace.
We've been talking with Mike Lewers. With Park City updates, I've got here in the studio with me Acting City Manager Jody Emery. And on the phone with us is Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we've got a pretty full agenda for the last meeting of the year. I want to start by hearing a little bit about the Clark Ranch easement discussion. Heather, we'll start with you. Obviously, the council talked about this quite a bit earlier this fall. Could you tell me a little bit about what has changed since the last time this came before the council?
Yes, we've been asked by the council from the last meeting to come back with the conservation easement before the end of the year. So we are coming back tomorrow evening with a potentially updated conservation easement for adoption. It will protect the majority of Clark Ranch while preserving a path forward for future affordable housing. What has changed since the last iteration proposed to the council is that we have the commitment from the Alexander Company, our partner and developer of the affordable housing project, to confine the development within 10 acres. So every aspect of the development would be within that 10 acres, including stormwater retention roads, other things like that. So the proposal that we are presenting to the council will be a conservation easement that is able to be adopted tomorrow night with a carve out of 15 acres while we continue forward with the identification of the most suitable 10 acres for that affordable housing project and give that an opportunity for further discussion with the city council and hopefully with the planning commission to determine that the best 10 acres for that project. And then we will return to the council with the remaining 5 acres for further protection, whether it be included or added to the conservation easement or otherwise protected in a very similar fashion.
Okay, understood. Do you have a sense of the timeline for when that 5 acres will be identified?
You know, we've been working with the Alexander Company to identify, the most suitable and feasible option for the 10 acres that we are planning that development for. That is ongoing. We're hoping within the first quarter of 2026 to schedule a joint planning commission and council meeting to discuss and identify those most suitable 10 acres. And as soon as that is done, we will return to the council with the remaining 5 acres for protection.
Okay. Now the Clark Ranch has been an issue that's received a lot of public comment, a lot of feedback over the course of the discussions. Do you feel like this solution is one that will satisfy the majority of Park City residents that, you know, that the balance of open space and development is being preserved?
You know, I'm really hopeful. I think we're trying to strike just the right balance here and support two significant priorities of the city and the council, one being the conservation easement and commitment that we made for the Clark Ranch property and the vast majority of that to be protected through a conservation easement with Utah Open Lands, and also the interest of the city and the council in building more affordable housing that is desperately needed in our city and particularly for our workforce. So what we've been trying to do here is to carve a path that is going to support both of those important outcomes. And I'm hopeful that our residents will appreciate that and see the value in that. We have really tried to present an option that's going to give the council the ability to adopt the conservation easement before the end of the year so that that can be in place and our residents can feel confident in the protections that are afforded to the vast majority of Clark Ranch property, while also giving us some flexibility to problem solve and to move forward on the Clark Ranch affordable housing development in a way that's going to give us a project that is meeting the needs of the community while also making it financially more suitable for the city to actually get that affordable housing built.
Will there be public comment at tomorrow's meeting for this item?
You know, we are not going to be taking public comment on this item tomorrow, which I know is a little bit unusual, but I just want to share with your listeners that we have received so much public comment on this item, that which we appreciate, that we have heard, that we have incorporated, that we are mindful of, and so we're not going to continue with further comment tomorrow.
Okay, understood. Moving on now to the Main Street area plan. Jody, maybe we could hear from you a little bit about what kind of progress has been made since we last heard an update on this project.
Sure. On the council meeting tomorrow, this is really a staff communications update only. Mm-hmm. The team is coming back. No formal action or deliberation is scheduled. It reflects the sort of piecemeal approach that the council has decided to take with the Main Street area plan. There are three parts of that approach that will be coming back just for the update. The first one is pedestrian and landscape improvements. So we've completed a LIDAR scan and survey, and this is a very fancy, high-tech, I called it like a Mission Impossible style scan of Main Street. So really getting precise measurements so that they can understand they can build concept level designs for sidewalks, the street layout, and circulation. So those studies are underway. They're hoping to create a pedestrian friendly street and sidewalk improvement. So that is work in progress. So they're just reporting on that, and we expect that to come back again in March with potentially for action. Mm-hmm. We also are looking at the thermal energy network and the snowmelt feasibility. So they're exploring a district scale thermal energy options within the historic commercial business district and the possibility of using it for street and sidewalk snowmelt. And we have a consultant. The procurement for the feasibility study is expected to conclude in January of 2026. And then that's a longer study, so that would then be probably a 9-month study after that's in place. And the last thing about the Main Street area plan that's coming back is the aerial transit feasibility. We are evaluating potential connections between Deer Valley's Snow Park, China Bridge Garage, and Richardson Flat. And the current work includes alignment evaluation, a right-of-way analysis, a landowner impact assessment, and a review of the aerial transit technologies. As you can imagine, that's a complicated process. And so we expect that to come back for more action in March. So tomorrow it's just an update.
Sounds good. Mm-hmm. For the snowmelt piece, is that essentially like heated sidewalks?
It's a geothermal loop that's utilizing heat existing in pipes and drains and other infrastructure already. It's a very cool idea. So the feasibility study is determining if it's something we can even accomplish within our infrastructure systems.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
And then I see you'll also be talking about an Olympic parade, and that's through YSA. It's been for the past two Winter Olympics. What exactly does the parade celebrate?
That is a great question. I apologize. I don't have that in front of me. So the parade is celebrating the Olympians who are coming back. Mm-hmm. This is something that we've done in the two previous Olympics, and the YSA is coming just to ask us if they can do that again this year, which I think is a really exciting way for the city to celebrate and get ready for the Olympics.
Sounds good. Yeah, I understand now we'll have a council vacancy to fill as well with Mayor-elect Ryan Dickey. Could you tell me a little bit about the process for filling that vacancy?
You bet. So we anticipate that Ryan Dickey, well, he's indicated that he is going to formally resign shortly after the December 18th council meeting. That will create the official vacancy. Mm-hmm. That will kickstart the process, which is defined by state law. Mm-hmm. The entire process is defined by state law, which the timing of it is awkward, and we acknowledge that because the application window is expected to open, if this goes as planned, December 23rd, mm-hmm. and it will close on January 5th. So it's right there in that holiday time when everybody is obviously thinking about a lot of other things. So mm-hmm. we want to make sure that we are encouraging people to be ready for that application window to open. And after that, after conducting interviews and deliberating in open meetings, the council will appoint a qualified resident to serve the remainder of the term that would expire in January 2028.
Okay. And who's eligible to apply for this?
They must be residents. The full list of qualifications will be included on the application. And you must have been a resident for a year. And there are some other, I guess, less important qualifications, but all must be checked. So that'll be available on the application.
Okay. And then what's the process for, like, what criteria will determine who fills that vacancy? I understand maybe public interviews are a big piece of it. Mm-hmm.
Council will do the interview process and based on their determination, and I haven't had any conversations with them about what their qualifications are for who they might choose.
Yeah, I guess we'll see who applies.
We'll see who applies, that's right.
Yeah. Moving on, I understand that this Friday we're starting the new shuttle service to Bonanza Flat. It sounds like a pretty expanded service this year compared to what's been offered in years past. Could you tell me a little bit about what's new?
Absolutely. So the shuttle service will be operating Friday through Sunday from 8:45 until 4:45 p.m. That'll go through April 19th, and that's obviously weather dependent. We will have a 30-minute frequency that'll be coordinated with the Purple Route, the Transit's Purple Route. So the initiative has been fully funded through the paid parking revenue from Bonanza Flat Trailhead during the summer of 2025. That was a really successful program this last summer, and it's going to support additional access to this area. So we're really excited about that. People will be able to ride the purple to the top and then follow the signs. We'll have signage letting you know where the shuttle is, when it picks up, and it'll be groomed regularly. The Bonanza area will be groomed regularly. It'll be open to Nordic skiing, fat biking, and snowshoeing. I have to say, as conditions allow.
Yeah.
Let's hope this rain is snow up there. I think it's a good chance up there. Dogs are welcome, so mm-hmm. That's fun. You can get on the bus with the muzzle and ride the shuttle then. And then the best way to stay informed about when it's running and weather issues is through the Mountain Trails Daily Reports on their social media. Mm-hmm. The city will let people know through Mountain Trails if the weather is challenging, and then we'll also be placing signs up top if for some reason the shuttle can't be running.
Okay, so now people, it sounds like, will not have to make a reservation for a spot on the shuttle anymore?
No, they have not indicated that you will need that. I think there's enough frequency that they're anticipating they should be able to meet the demand.
Wow, okay, so that's those parking fees at work?
Yeah, it is your parking fees at work.
Sounds
right.
Good.
Yeah.
In related news, the council's looking at a trail maintenance contract with the Mountain Trails Foundation. Is the scope of that contract expanding as well?
I believe that it is the same scope of the contract. It's a two-year agreement totaling $290,000. Mountain Trails had a five-year contract previous to this, so it's more or less a renewal with, I believe, a slight increase for increase in costs. What it does cover is the long-term trail maintenance for and winter grooming services for our vast open space and trail network that includes Round Valley, it includes Bonanza Flat, and also some resort areas. And the purpose of this contract is to provide year-round trail access, which we think is very important to our residents and our visitors. And they have Mountain Trails has a very long-standing trusted relationship with the city.
Sounds good. Heather, maybe we can go back to you. I'd love to hear about what else is on the calendar for Park City as you close out the year. I know there's an Engine House ribbon cutting up, some other things like that. What is on the calendar for the next couple of weeks?
You know, we do have a few things. One is that Engine House ribbon cutting that you mentioned. That's on Friday, December 19th at 10 a.m. This will celebrate the completion of Park City's largest public-private affordable housing partnership to date, 99 deed restricted units, serving households earning up to 60% of AMI. We're really excited about that. Mayor Nan Worrell will deliver remarks. We also have a swearing-in ceremony. This will be just over into the beginning of the year, but also just want people to mark their calendars. January 5th, 4 p.m. at the Bob Wells Plaza. This will be for Mayor-elect Ryan Dickey and council members-elect Canatoli and Diego Zagara. It's free, open to the public. We'll have some refreshments. We encourage people to ride our free Park City Transit if they'd like to attend, but we'd love for you all to come out.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. Well, never a dull moment in Park City. Anything else coming up that either of you would like to add?
That's okay. I think we've covered most of everything we have coming up soon, other than I'll just reiterate, holiday light season, we do like dark skies, so residents do need to be turning off their lights at 10 and businesses at 11. And otherwise, the council meeting tomorrow is our ugly sweater meeting, so if you're
going
to...
I was just going to say that.
If you're going to show up, you better show up in an ugly sweater, which always makes for a funny evening.
Sounds good. A festive way to end the year.
A festive way to end the year, that's right.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much to you both for all of the updates on Park City.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Faith.
We've been talking with Judy Emery and Heather Sneddon from Park City. There was a Heber City Council meeting last night, and on the phone with us is Heber City Council Member Yvonne Barney. She is here to share a few updates. Yvonne, good morning.
Good morning, Grace.
thanks so much for joining us. Well, it was the last it was the last meeting of the year last night, and it's been a busy year. Looking back at 2025, I'm curious what you are most proud of having accomplished as a city this year.
I think looking back on 2025, I would say as far as accomplishments, we were able to put together more information and develop a better plan for the Chaz area, which is our central Heber. It's an ongoing process. I'm hoping that as we do this and continue forward, that we will be able to use that these new ordinances as an ability to protect and keep our little area in the Chaz area, which is our downtown area and our downtown residential areas. Small, without high impact, as best as possible, and enable property owners to put in ADUs and, you know, provide some income property and at the same time provide affordable housing for our essential workers in our community. So that is probably, for me, one of the best things that we have done going forward.
Yeah, and I feel like affordability is something I often hear you talk about as a priority for you.
It is.
Looking ahead to 2026, you are starting a second term on the council, 4 more years. With that new term beginning, what are your top priorities as you're looking ahead next year for Heber City?
I think probably looking ahead for me, at least for me, my top priorities would be, as always, it's always going to be listen to the citizens. I'm hoping that, you know, recognizing that some citizens may not agree with my method of councilship, if you will, but always being willing to listen to what they have to say. And I said, second, like you said yourself, affordability. I don't use that word often. I think you know that. I try to say things like attainable. I think there's very little that's affordable, but we're really making a mark. And I think going forward, it's going to take some thinking out of the box. You know, start looking into small home parks, if you will. We've seen them in Austin and Seattle and so many other areas and communities. And I think Utah and especially Heber City, that's something that we can benefit from. Also looking into protecting our rental properties. I think that when we allow large institutional organizations to come in and to kind of scoop up those affordable homes, especially in the Chaz area, it creates less affordable. It also puts each property into the perspective of how many families can I get into my home so that I can afford my rent. Mm-hmm. That's not affordable. We need to do better. And I'm thinking that maybe we start looking at not just short-term rental policies, but also long-term rental policies. How do we protect these properties? How do we make sure that landlords are doing what they need to and that they're providing properly for those individuals who are renting in their homes. So those are some things that I might be looking at as well. And as also just going forward, I think that will probably be the most important thing for me. I think last night, I don't know if you want me to lead into this, but
sure.
We had a couple of good groups that have come forward with some plans that even I can get behind. I have been the queen of no when it comes to high density housing, but there are exceptions, and I feel that some of those exceptions might include the two developers that came through last night in the form of Celebration Housing, which is through the Russ Watts organization, and then Garbett Homes and what they're trying to do with the property on East Center Street.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Garbett Homes. It's a townhome proposal, I think about 30. And You mentioned that maybe you'd like to see some smaller homes for maybe single parents or empty nesters or elderly folks. Do you feel like that's a part of the housing supply that's really missing in Heber right now?
I really do. I think that we kind of missed that section of our community. There's a lot of single parents out there who need that extra assist, if you will, but they want a home. They want to provide space for their children. They don't, some are comfortable in apartment dwellings, but I think by doing something also that provides for those individuals who would like to have a place for their kids to run around and to, you know, a little bit more space. At times it can be very difficult if you do have kids and you are a single parent to find a place, because some people, you know, for whatever reasons they might have, some property owners do not like to have families or large families, and especially dogs, which is understandable. But it makes it difficult when they're trying to find something that is good and someplace safe for their children. And I think that is a area that we are woefully misrepresenting when we are looking at the attainable housing. And so that's something I kind of spend and hope that, you know, the Garbutt Homes will consider it. We did have that discussion, however, that if we do just a single floor, I don't know if you heard that, but part of the problem with that is it is actually more expensive. So even putting in a two-bedroom townhome is something that would be with two baths or even a one and a half bath. I think that is something that is where we need to start having our developers look at and making it deed restricted. That does make a difference.
Yeah. Just how expensive is it to buy a home in Heber these days?
Wow. Expensive. You know, when you see those little icons with the little dollar signs and how expensive each item is, we could probably go way over into about four icons of the dollar sign.
Wow. So,
we are, from all reports that are said, when it comes to purchasing, it depends on the area, of course, and depends on the size. But for average, I would say the average home within Heber Valley is probably anywhere from $8 to over $1 million. And that is your three-bedroom, two-bath, unfinished basement homes to, of course, larger sizes. So,
yeah,
it's pretty difficult. Let's put it this way, in perspective, if I were to move here now, my husband and I would not be able to live here. We purchased our home for $52,000 back in the day. Obviously, there's been a lot of changes, but never like we're seeing now.
Yeah. You shared an interesting statistic last night. I think you said you need a household income of something like $170,000 to buy a home in Heber right now.
Yes, so that's what the statistics are. It was on an article that I read, actually a couple of articles that I've read. It's varying anywhere from $135,000 to $170,000, and that's just for your median housing. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's kind of a problem that we're seeing across the country, real estate expense, and not seeing our wages going up much higher, making it unattainable. You know, our interest rates as a matter of interest is out of 5 right now, which is a little bit closer. We're starting to hit the mark, but we still have not seen wages really increase significantly across the board. And I think that makes a difference as well. And that's something with Celebration Housing, if I can just go right into that quickly.
Yeah.
Again, high density. I was not a proponent for it when it first passed with council. I actually voted no, because to me it is extremely high. But I also recognize that once that yes has been given, once they start coming in, they start discussing with us and sharing with us what they would like to accomplish, I'm more willing to listen to that and find ways that we can provide what we need for our community. And last night, some of those details with Celebration. excuse me, is that, you know, I'm more interested in this property because of what it can do and how it can help families to kind of get to that point. You know, part of the problem we're seeing with rentals right now in this area is that we have rental properties that are so significantly high, and without having the wages, like I discussed earlier, it makes it difficult. You're just barely making, you're supposed to be at least a 30% difference. And in this case, you're finding that many are barely making it. They are trying to make their rent, trying to make their utilities, all of those things, and are barely able to make a dent on it. So there's no future for them. Celebration will provide net affordable housing at 60% AMI. All of them will be rentals and leases. So there's no opportunity for individuals to come in, purchase a house, and then rent them out at a higher rate. It helps with providing an ability to, you know, keep their head above water, and then maybe save up for the future, which is really what we want people to do. It's close to our hospitals, close to our schools, public safety buildings. That's priority. That really brings in those individuals who want to stay close to their jobs, and they are essential workers. And it's next to a major roadway, central location to, you know, restaurants and everything else. So I think that's one plus that it has. I think these are all pluses that Celebration has, and we're planning on doing a lot more communication with them. We still need to kind of tweak, if you will, that MOU with them going forward, but I think they're receptive, and that's what matters, as is the Garbutt Homes. They're receptive and are willing to find ways to provide this much-needed, you know, deficit in our community.
Yeah, fill those housing needs.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, a couple of interesting projects to keep an eye on as we head into 2026.
For sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
We have about a minute left. Is there anything else you want listeners to know before I let you go?
No, I'm excited for our new council member to come on. And Morgan Murdoch, sorry, I shouldn't mention his name. I'm excited for us to just kind of start a new year. I hope that we can have really good communication as a council. I feel that, you know, that is vital to getting things done, if you will. So going forward, I hope that's something that we'll be able to accomplish. And, you know, a shout out to Mr. Phillips and for some of the good things that he has done. And I hope that his future will be enjoying his family and, you know, and kind of taking it easy and doing what he enjoys with his family.
Sounds good.
Yeah, that's it.
Sounds good. Well, Yvonne, thank you so much for sharing these updates. I appreciate the news from Heber.
Thank you, Grace. Thank you so much.
And happy
holidays.
Have
a wonderful Christmas.
You too.
You as well. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. We've been speaking with Heber City Council member Yvonne Barney.